So once upon a time, there was this 30-something guy in May, about 2,600 years ago, who woke up. I mean, really woke up. And he found himself in a grove of fig trees along the Niranjara River in the Ganges Valley. And the story of how he got there, he was a member of a warrior clan, the Sakyans. The story of how he got there is really interesting, but it's for another time. But he woke up, he became a Buddha. And eventually he was given the name Siddhartha, which literally means one who accomplished his goal. But we don't actually know what his given name was. His family name was Gotama. So he woke up in this grove of fig trees after a pretty intensive practice for 6.5 years. And so then the question was, now what? And what he had accomplished was so simple and so ordinary and so organic and at the same time so subtle and so nuanced that he wasn't sure that he could convey it to anybody. So he just hung out there in amongst the fig trees for about a month, just letting it all soak in. It's liberation, full enlightenment. And during that time, he began to realize that, yeah, probably most people wouldn't get it, but there were a few. You know, perhaps Alara Kalama, that was his first teacher. He was very close. And you know, maybe Alara Kalama wouldn't get it. Maybe he'd get it, in a long time. But maybe he could kind of help him, give him a few pointers. But there was a problem with that. Alara Kalama was dead. So what about Uddaka Ramaputta? Was his second teacher. He was an even more advanced teacher, very famous teacher back in his day, and he had trained with him for a while and mastered all he had to teach. And he could probably get this. But he was dead too. Well, then there were his old meditation buddies. After he had gone through all those teachers, he went out and meditated on his own, but wasn't completely on his own. There were these five ascetics, and they had practiced together, none of them being a teacher, but just in support of each other. And well, they were very close. So yeah, so he set out to go find these guys and see if he could convey some of this. And as he was walking down the road, there was this young ascetic named Upaka, not Uddaka, but Upaka, who saw him walking up the road, and as you could imagine, here's a fully enlightened Buddha. And just the serenity, the contentment, the size of his aura. And so Upaka goes up to him and he says, so who are you? You know, what's your name? And who is your teacher? You know, Upaka wanted to know who his teacher was so he could get more of what this guy had. So this was the Buddha's first student. And the Buddha felt so inspired, he just answered his question, you know, quite directly. And in the Majjhima Nikaya, this is what he said to Upaka. I am one who has transcended all, a knower of all, unsullied among all things, renouncing all, by craving ceasings freed. I have no teacher and no one like me exists anywhere in all the world with all its gods, because I have no person for my counterpart. And it goes on like that in verse. So, what would you think? You know? So, you're walking down through, you know, some public space, you know, maybe in a subway or something, and there's this guy, you know, who just seems to glow, and you walk up to him and you introduce himself, and he starts rapping in cadence. I am the accomplished one in the world. I am the teacher supreme. I alone am a fully enlightened one whose fires are quenched and extinguished. Would you think he was on drugs? Had a screw loose, or you know, some wiring got messed up in there? The Majjhima Nikaya records Upaka's response. When this was said, when the Buddha was done talking to him, when this was said, the ascetic Upaka said, "May it be so, friend." Shaking his head, he took a bypath and departed. This was the Buddha's first student. And I picture the Buddha, you know, standing there watching Upaka, you know, scurry down the way away from him and thinking, that didn't go so well. You know? I've had some things not go so well for me. I was in the ministry for 25 years. I'm safe. It's a progressive ministry, Unitarian Universalist. When people find out I'm a minister, you know, sitting on an airplane next to them, I can see them just sort of scan back of the mind over the conversation the last 45 minutes and see if they swore or something. So I spent 25 years in the ministry, and I would get a month of vacation and a month of study leave, and things slowed down in the summer, so I usually took my vacation early in the summer, would go off and meditate for a couple of weeks, and then spend a couple of weeks vacation with the family. And then I would go into my study leave time, where I was not interacting with the congregation, but was, reading and getting ready so I could hit the ground running in September. And when September came around, I was inspired. It's like I had learned all kinds of new stuff, had read all kinds of things, I had my practice, and I just poured my heart into that first sermon. And people would greet me at the door. Nice effort. Sort of glazed over a little bit. I had just gone right past them. The mistake that I made over and over again was I was paying more attention to what inspired me and not so much attention to them. You know? So then for the next several days or several weeks, as I reconnected with the congregation going around and talking, you know, to people, I had two questions in the back of my mind. What are their concerns? And do I have anything useful to say about that? And I would use that to guide the subsequent writing. And within, a week or so, people were greeting me at the door with good eye contact and telling stories, you know, that are related to the topic, and we were back in the groove together. So I think that's what happened with the Buddha. I don't want to compare myself to a Buddha, but I was just my little tiny piece of that, is that he was, I wouldn't say overwhelmed, that's not an appropriate word, but was just so inspired by all he'd found that he just wasn't paying attention to who Upaka was. So the next people that he met were his old meditation buddies, the five ascetics. Well, at least that we have any record of. And the Buddha was, if anything, was an incredible teacher. And so he learned, and he really got who they were, and he spoke directly to them. And one of them, Kodanya, the Bhikkhu Kodanya, woke up while he was talking. And the rest of them had to practice a few days, but they woke up too. And we can be grateful to Kodanya and those ascetics, because I think if he had flunked out that time, he probably would have gone back to the fig grove and disappeared from history. But that's when Buddhism actually came into the world. So it would have been awfully nice if they had taken some notes. But what they did was, he didn't take notes. The sacred material was not written down then. But they listened and they repeated what they remembered, and they had these five different versions of it. And those people who heard that repeated it, and after a couple hundred years, somebody finally wrote it all down. And the version of that talk you can find in the Samyutta Nikaya, number 5611. And in that talk, the one to the five ascetics, there are a bunch of things that are in that. But the core of it is what I would call three essential practices. Three essential practices. They have come down to us as the Four Noble Truths. But I think that that title is somewhat misleading. First of all, they aren't truths with a capital T. They're not metaphysical pronouncements about ultimate reality. They are just ordinary, mundane observations. We all hurt from time to time. You don't want to hear never hurt? You know? Stress feels worse than relaxation. These are just ordinary observations. They aren't noble. There's nothing noble about stress or pain or suffering. Right? In Pali, the word noble doesn't refer to the observations. It refers to the mind of someone who engages these wisely. Right? So Stephen Batchelor, for example, calls them the four ennobling truths. So they are ones that if you engage. And each of those observations has a practice. It's right there in the text with it. The Buddha, so this was the meditation he was teaching of how to engage these observations. And there aren't four of them. There's only three. You know? So the so-called fourth noble truth is not an observation at all. It's not a truth at all. It's this collection. It's the Eightfold Path. It's a checklist. I think what the Buddha was saying, you know, if you engage these three practices and if it's not working for you, here's a checklist of eight items, very useful checklist of eight items that you can look at to fine-tune your practice. So in the West, religion is usually defined by statements of faith, by declarations of metaphysical reality that cannot be empirically proved or disproved. That's what we consider, you know, religion in the West, at least popular religion. The Buddha was not interested in metaphysical pronouncements. He was not interested in those views. He was interested in how we engage our everyday experience. But the first people who translated these were the Jesuits, and I have a lot of respect for the Jesuits. Back about 500 years ago, they didn't understand this about Buddhism. So they elevated the observations to truth, and they slid over the practices altogether. So to understand these three essential practices, I think it's helpful to understand three Pali terms and three practices. So the terms are dukkha, tanha, and nirodha. And the practices are understanding, abandoning, and realizing. The Buddha said that dukkha is to be understood. It's right there in the text. He said that tanha is to be abandoned, and nirodha is to be realized. So let me unpack these a little bit. So the first practice is understanding dukkha. So what's dukkha?
Suffering.
Unsatisfactoriness.
Pressure. Incessant pressure.
Lack of ease. Life. Yeah. So Lee Brazington, it was here a year ago, I think. He has on his website, and in the talk he gave here, it was at the old place, but he translates dukkha as bummer. Right? And the beauty of it is that bummer runs the whole gamut from, you know, pain, terror, you know, to just, oh, I can't wait for my vacation. You know? So it's a suffering dissatisfaction of all those. So there is nothing profound, there's nothing noble about, you know, belly aches and broken teeth and broken hearts and grief and loss and all the rest. So what the Buddha said was that we need to understand suffering. Right? We need to understand suffering. So to understand someone, it's not like you give them a diagnosis or just, you know, put a label on them. To really understand someone, or when we feel someone understands us, they kind of know us empathetically. They know us from the inside. They know how we tick. We know our aspirations, our fears, our inspirations. And so the Buddha was saying that we need to have this kind of intimacy with suffering, to know what makes it tick. You know, to know how it arises, how it hangs around, how it fades. Really need to understand, not just intellectually, but in our guts, how suffering actually operates. By the way, the Buddha didn't say life is suffering or life is a bummer. He just said it has suffering. It has bummers. It has dissatisfaction. And we need to understand it. Now, obviously, you're not going to understand suffering if you're trying to beat it, if you're trying to overcome it, if you're trying to run from it. So I, just to work it down into modern vernacular, take this first practice is turning towards. Just turning towards whatever life brings along. And if it's suffering, of just turning towards it. So we can get to know it intimately. Not our stories about it, not our concepts about it. Our stories and concepts, boy, if our thoughts could liberate us, we'd be living in a different world, you know. But it's to really get it. So when we engage dukkha in this way, what we begin to see is that our experience of suffering, bummers, dissatisfaction, ennui, is rooted in tanha, rooted in tanha. So this brings us to the second practice, which is abandoning tanha. So who knows what tanha is?
Thirst.
Thirst is what it literally means, yeah.
Craving.
Craving is a common translation of it.
Looking for a reality to be something other than what it is.
Right, yeah. If I were God and I was making reality, I would do this differently. So tanha is actually, all those are correct. And tanha is a whole wide range of things. It is a pre-verbal, pre-conceptual, physical, mental, and emotional tightening. It's quite simple. You're about to cross the street, and there's this little tightening that happens inside that gets you to look up and, you know, up and down the street for traffic danger. It's a little... a big one I always think about is you're driving down the road and somebody, you know, cuts across your lane of traffic, you know, and you feel your hands tightening on the steering wheel. You know. That's all tanha. Or you see something that looks delicious. And the body will actually tighten up a little bit as you move towards it. We usually don't notice the tension because we're focused on the object out there. The thing that we want or that we don't want to get rid of. But if we look inside, you see this tightening. It's not willful. I always hear yogis say, oh, I tightened up inside. No, you didn't do it. It just happened. It's a complex biological reflex. And I think here a couple times ago I was here, I actually talked about tanha for a long time, about how it's got it. It juices our system. And there's a huge evolutionary advantage to it. Only evolution doesn't really care whether we're feeling good or not. It just cares about whether we procreate, right? Whether our DNA gets to be passed along. But it is a pre-verbal, pre-intellectual, instinctual, complex reflex, a tightening. And it is the root of our sense of self. So before there's tanha, and then there's just this flow of experience, and then with a little bit of tension, the mind starts to split reality into things I want or don't want, and a me that wants it or doesn't want it. But prior to that, there's just a flow of experience. So tanha, it has been translated as craving, but it's not really like, it's not always like a junkie looking for their next hit. It can be this very gentle thing. When you're bored, you know, you feel the mind will kind of thicken. You know, that's a form of tanha too. So when we fully understand tanha, we see that our suffering, our experience of suffering, arises out of tension. And so the practice that goes with tanha is abandon. The Buddha said, abandon tanha, abandon the tension. When I'm looking at the text, I like to get 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 translations from scholars I respect and see how they translate these words. And every one of them translates the Pali term there as abandon. It's a very dramatic term. The Buddha was saying, just walk away from it. Don't have anything more to do with it. So how do you abandon tension? You relax. You relax. It's really that simple. It's really that simple. And as I was saying earlier, I like to say relax into, so that it's not a matter of relaxing as a way to get away from something. But you turn towards, you release the tension, you relax, and it feels like you're relaxing into it. I live, Maurice Sendak has a description of this in Where the Wild Things Are, where Max tamed all the wild things with the magic trick of staring into all their yellow eyes without blinking once. That has a little tension in it, but I like that sort of turning towards and just kind of opening up to and just being there with it. It goes against our fight or flight instinct. It goes against a lot of stuff that's wired in. So it's important to be really kind to yourself with this. And if you get uptight about it, just relax the tension and the uptightness. I was meditating where I can meditate, you know, for an hour and a half on retreat, maybe 2 hours fairly regularly, until I began practicing this way, and then suddenly I was sitting 3 or 4 hours. The reason people have difficulty sitting long is because of accumulated tension, and if you're meditating, if you're relaxing the tension, it's no problem. So notice that that we don't abandon the suffering. The suffering we understand, that's the practice there, but it's the tension that we just soften out of. So to say it succinctly, seeing the source of suffering is not necessarily uplifting. To see the source of suffering in tension is not uplifting. It's the abandoning of it that ennobles, that uplifts. Okay. So when we abandon tension, then this brings us to the third practice, which is nirodha. The Buddha's third practice was realizing nirodha. So nirodha is oftentimes translated as cessation. How many of you are familiar with the term? Oh, it's really important. It's like overlooked in the West a lot. It's a practice that goes with the third noble truth. Nirodha is it literally means cessation. And so with the tension and tanha, it ceases. And tanha comes in these different flavors, liking, disliking, and confusion. And so nirodha is oftentimes defined as the absence of those three. And I think that that's accurate, but it's not terribly informative. So, for example, let's say I had a lovely day, and you ask me, oh, well, what was lovely about it? And I'd tell you, well, we didn't have any sandstorms. Or I just had this wonderful couple-day hike up in the High Sierras, and somebody says, oh, well, what was so wonderful about it? And I say, well, there was no raping and pillaging. So to say that Naroda is the absence of tension, that just tells us what's not. It doesn't really tell us what it is. So the experience of Naroda, the best way I can describe it is the experience of pure awareness, which is awareness that doesn't have any tension in it. Okay. So awareness that doesn't have any tension in it is quite clear, so it just sees things, so it's wise, because it's the tension in the mind that distort our seeing. Awareness that doesn't have any tension in it is not busy comparing one thing to another. So it's agendaless. So it's just looking at things without preference. Ah, that seemed what it is. So it feels very kind. And it feels kind and loving. And when we experience it deeply, there's beginning of this sense that's actually been here all along. You know, pure awareness is what's behind all the tense awareness we have. So I was thinking about this once, and my best description of it, it's like you're in a classroom, and the kids are yelling, and they're banging the chairs, and they're throwing erasers, and they're all carrying it on, and just, you know. And over in the corner, there's somebody who's writing poetry, and you wouldn't even notice her because of all the hubbub. And then you come in early one day, and the classroom is empty, except the poet is over there. So you go over there and talk to her a little bit, or you just sit quietly as she composes. And then as you sit there, the other kids start coming in with their boom boxes and punching in the arms, and you know, and pretty soon all the cacophony is back. But now, in the midst of all this cacophony, you can still sense the poet, you know, because you know what she feels like. You can sense it through that. We can't create pure awareness. We can't create it because it's always here. Any attempt to create it just adds more tension to it. All we can do is relax into it. Okay. So here's a little exercise. I'm going to hold up my arm, and I'm just going to let it drop. Okay. Now, when I let it drop, I invite you to drop all your thoughts. Okay? So here we are. Should we do it again? So did you notice a little pause there? You know, and then very quickly, the mind starts up thinking again, and so it all goes under. But there's that little break there. That's pure awareness. In the Tibetan Mahamudra tradition, they call it the natural mind. And I learned this little demonstration from Mingyur Rinpoche. So let's do it one more time. And don't worry about hanging on to the emptiness. It won't work. But just see if there's a little pause there. So easy. It's so easy. It's hard to maintain, but it's so easy. The Mahamudra tradition They're part of their beginning instructions is to do that 200 times a day, not necessarily with hands, but to just pause for a moment and let all your thinking drop. So right now, just as you look around the room, just let your thoughts. I notice you, there's a lot of you, there's a tendency to smile as you do that. Because it's this, because the natural mind is naturally uplifted. It almost has a glow to it. So pure awareness is not just an absence. Pure awareness has that feel and texture. Right? It's very soft. And as you allow yourself to notice it more, you can use that to just let your mind rest there just for a few moments, you know, during practice. And just keep coming back. Don't try to hold on to it, but just keep coming back. Or when I'm, you know, walking out in the woods or something like that, I'll notice my mind is going on. I just let it drop for a moment. And then it starts back up again. But what they're after in the Mahamudra tradition is to just experience that little break in the thought stream. That's pure awareness. So the Buddha's third essential practice, was realizing Nirodha. So what does realize mean in this context? Yeah, just experience it. And there are successive depths of Nirodha. So the simplest, most obvious one is just abandoning tension. And as the tension goes away, there's a moment, just like you drop your thoughts there. The problem is that the peacefulness that remains behind does nothing to draw our attention to it. And the brain is very much drawn towards stimulation, but it's not drawn towards lack of stimulation. Right? So it takes some training to just begin to notice that. Because the peacefulness is not going to jump up and down and say, I'm over here. You know? So you just relax into it. So realizing Nirodha, what that means, I think, is just to savor those peaceful moments, to make them real. To savor them means to make them real. They're not just phantoms. And this is the third practice the Buddha gave. I think, as I said before, I think it's been overlooked. And what it does is it allows some of that peace and equanimity to kind of soak into our bones so that when the next piece of stress comes along, there's a little more space inside. So as the Nirodha goes deeper, so first they're just those moments, as it goes deeper, we begin to notice where it comes from. So let me give you this example. Say you've been hankering for something sweet all day. You know, and looking about it, and you're thinking about it, and sort of yearning for it, etc. And then you get home, and there's, I don't know, what, some chocolate or flan or mango or something there. And you go and you take that first bite. And it's bliss. It's so sweet. And it lasts about maybe two breaths, you know, where the mind wants to go for the second bite. Right? So again, when we take the bite, we're paying attention to the flavor there, but not paying attention to what's going on in the mind. But if you pay attention to what's going on in the mind, you'll notice that what happens is the desire for something sweet evaporates. You don't want it anymore because now you've got it. And that's where that peacefulness comes from. And what we have done is we have mistaken getting what we want with not wanting. And, you know, we, particularly in the West, we're the gods on Mount Olympus. I mean, we can produce pleasures like nobody in history has done, and yet we're all, you know, dying of stress-induced diseases and stress-induced politics. Well, we won't go into that. So when you realize that the peace and the well-being come from the lack of tension, then you stop fighting the noisy kids. You stop fighting the distractions in your mind. You just turn towards them, relax the tension in it, and just allow some of that peacefulness to come in, and then savor it, and just savor it. And so as it goes deeper, what you realize is not only that it's the lack of that grasping, but that it's been here all along. It's like the poet in the classroom, that it's always here. It's always here. Can you feel it right now? It's like just a little bit of something back there. Oh, there it is. Well, then it's gone. Yeah. But just notice that. There's an art to just recognizing and relaxing as opposed to recognizing and grabbing it. And what begins to happen, and there's kind of a figure background shift, where rather than being in stress and seeing peaceful moments in your life, there's a peacefulness, and you see the stress out there. And I'm going to go on the deep end with this, because there's a deeper form of Naroda, which goes like this. That if you notice, to form a memory, to remember something, takes a little bit of tension just to push that experience into memory. Okay? And to even perceive something takes a little bit of tension, even if it's just to put a label on it. We do this automatically all the time. But as the mind gets more and more peaceful, as the tension drains out of it, you know, progressively, then there comes a time where memory and perception start to go offline. It's called cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. I call it winking out. There's a moment when you're not there, and unlike nodding off, you know, winking out, when you come back, the mind is just luminous. There's just that little, then, oh, what's that, you know. So some of you probably haven't experienced that, but don't worry, you know, it'll come. It'll come with practice. And there are probably more of you that have experienced it than you realize, just because you haven't had, because it's so hard to actually just point it out without grabbing. But let me, this is a poem about Naroda. And so if you can resonate with this at all, then someplace inside you, you've actually felt this. So this is called Lake by Gail Turnbull. I remember once in a far-off country, it doesn't matter where or even when. It had been a hot day and a lot of work to be done. And I was tired. I stopped by the road and walked across a field and came to the shores of a lake. The sun was bright on the water, and I swam out from the shore into the deep, cold water, far out of my depth, and I forgot. For a moment, I forgot where I had come from, where I was going, what I had done yesterday, what I had to do tomorrow, even my work, my home, my friends, even my name, alone in the deep water with the sky above. And whether that lake was a lake of the shore of some great sea or some lost tributary of time itself, for a moment I looked through, I passed through, I had one glimpse, as it happened one day in that far-off country. For a moment, it was so. Buddha's core practice includes realizing Naroda, including just that very simple first step of just a little bit of a pause, and it unfolds down into this, where Nirodha is the doorway into Nibbana, actually. So these core practices are all woven together. Understanding dukkha, abandoning tanha, and realizing Nirodha are not necessarily separate practices, but they are a foundation for Buddhist practice. And they appear in lots of different forms in all kinds of different Buddhist practices. So they form a core of a practice, and they also form, and this is really important, they form the core of an attitude towards life. And for me, Buddhism is not a set of beliefs. It's not a set of practices at its core. It's not a set of beliefs or practices or rituals or codes of conduct. Buddhism has all those things. It has all those things. But at its core, in its essence, Buddhism is just this attitude of turning towards whatever comes up, relaxing into it, and savoring whatever peacefulness comes up. When Erica and I were raising our boys, we didn't want them to have sugar, particularly soda, but we didn't want them to have it get a big complex about it. So every Saturday they got a little cup of Coke, you know. And my second son, I don't know where he learned this, but he would put the little glass there, and he would look at it, and he would smell it, and he would turn his cheek to it, and then he would take just a little sip, swirl it down. He'd just melt it for whatever it's worth, you know. He didn't learn that from me. So, savoring Nirodha, savoring the peacefulness when it comes up. So here's an image. I could just put all this together. For the first 16 years of my life, I grew up in Houston, Texas. On hot summer days, my mother used to pile her 5 children, of which I was the second, into our family Chevy station wagon and drive us down to Galveston so he could go out and swim in the Gulf of Mexico. Galveston is 60 miles from Houston, and Houston is 60 feet above sea level. So that gives you an indication of the lay of the land. It slopes down at a rate of 1 foot per mile. It's about as flat can be. And when the land goes into the Gulf of Mexico, it doesn't get much steeper. So when we went down and were swimming in the Gulf of Mexico, we could wade out, you know, 100 feet and just be up to our knees or thighs. And so if a big wave came along, to run from the wave was futile. You know, it's really hard to run through water. You know, and that shore was a long way away. If we ran, the wave would just catch us from behind and knock us over. So gradually what we learned was to actually, when a wave came, is we would plant our feet, you know, into the sand, and, you know, on the seafloor there, and brace against it. And that worked for small waves. But for big waves, you know, water is really heavy, you know. For big waves, they would just wipe us out. And gradually we learned just to actually relax into the waves, and when we got into it, we would dive and relax into them. This is how the Buddha recommended that we approach meditation and approach life. Whatever comes forward or whatever comes our way, just relax into it. And as frothy and scary as the waves can be, you know, in a moment they just wash over you and they're gone. You know, and then you're left in the essence of the wave, which is just water. Not so bad. Not so bad. And then a little bit of natural buoyancy just brings us up to a little quiet trough between the waves. One caveat. If we're freaked out or upset, looking at what's going on through that kind of tense, distorted awareness, it really doesn't help. We could get knocked over anyway. So in order to do this, we have to turn towards life with a quieting mind and an opening heart. Okay. We all have our limits. So if the mind heart is uptight, and no matter what we do, we can't relax, then it's wisest to just do whatever you can to help the mind settle and stabilize. And that's where you get this huge variety of practices, many ways to practice, you know, using koans, using the breath to stabilize the practice. I've come to use Brahmavihara's kindness, compassion, sending that out. Many, many different type of practices to kind of help the mind stabilize so that we can then kind of openly turn towards what's going on. But it's very important to realize that once the mind stabilizes, that's not enough. My practice plateaued for 25 years, and I didn't understand this. As the Burmese meditation master Sayadaw Utejaniya says, if the mind never comes off the object of awareness, if the awareness doesn't come off of the object and onto awareness itself, to where you have awareness of awareness, your practice just won't go very deep. So as the mind stabilizes, it's important to become aware of the qualities of awareness. So what's the quality of your mind right now? Is it peaceful? Is it simple? Is it tight? Is it bored? Is it wondering how long this is going to go on? Is it grateful? To just notice what it is. None of those states are better than any others. To just notice that. So by all means, do whatever you need to do to help the mind stabilize. And then pay attention to the awareness itself. I had some exercises we were going to do. Never mind. I'll tell you what the exercises are in case some of you are interested. I have four questions I was going to have you get in the pairs that all have to do with the four ennobling truths. How does life rub you the wrong way? Right? This is turning towards suffering? No. To just, what are the particular flavors of suffering that are attracted to you? How does life rub you the wrong way? How do you relate to difficulty? So the Buddha recommended abandoning tanha, but how is it that you habitually relate to stress in your life? And just get to know that, because unless you know your habitual patterns, you're not going to be able to release them. And the third practice is where do you find contentment? And it's really important to just notice where you find contentment because the mind skips over it so easily. And then that Eightfold Path, Eightfold Checklist is, I reduce down to the question, what helps? You know, what helps you? So I'll leave these here if you want to.
Yeah, I can also put them online.
Okay. Good. We'll take maybe a couple questions, but I would close here with, this is from my journal. Walking through the fields along the American River, my mind ambled off into little vignettes about different people and situations. Some of the stories were embellished memories. Others were pure fiction. But they all had a similar outline. Somebody was treating me badly, and I was calling them out for it. I thought, this is interesting. I shifted my attention from the plot to the feeling tone of the thoughts. There was a sharp bitterness behind each story. Forgiveness is wiser than bitterness, I thought. So I sat down out there in the woods and I closed my eyes and I began a forgiveness meditation. The mind heart resisted. It preferred bitterness to manufactured forgiveness. I've pushed my mind around so much that, in my early years, so I've come to trust that the mind knows how to untangle itself. So I didn't want to push it in a direction that it didn't want to go. So instead, I got out some writing paper, and I began to list people against whom I held a grudge. I didn't write about why, and I stayed away from the stories. Don't believe the stories in your mind. I don't believe them. Instead, I relaxed and wrote about the feelings that arose. Underneath the bitterness was hurt or loneliness or poignancy. I let go of the labels, let go of the concepts, and just softened into those tones and textures. After doing this for a short time, I noticed I was smiling. There was still heartache or lonesomeness, but there was also a glowing well-being that left me beaming without realizing it. As I became more aware of that glowing in the back of my mind, it spread. Soon it was difficult to remember what had been upsetting or even who the difficult people were. Back home an hour later, the glow still suffused my awareness. It was as if the mind heart just wanted me to notice those negative feelings without judging them. Simple awareness allowed for them to release and for the natural buoyancy to surface. So, we have a few minutes left for a question or a comment or an observation.
Yes, I was wondering, where does the craving come from? Are we predisposed to it? And what do you do with the craving? Do you give in to it? You surrender? You observe? So what is it?
The craving, I think, is a biologically based instinctual tightening that if you imagine that there's a threat out there or something that's needed, what happens is the tanha supercharges us and directs our attention towards it. And creatures who didn't care about whether they lived or got something to eat, they were taken out of the gene pool really quickly. So it just got wired into us by biological forces. I don't think it's metaphysical.
Resources.
Resources. Yeah. So it just predisposes us that way. And when we were a marginal species on a planet that had giant predators, it kept us alive, But now that we're on the top of the food chain, we're our only real enemy. We're at risk unless we can learn how to relax it. But I don't think you can stop it, at least not in the moment. But as you practice relaxing over and over and over again, it gradually wires the brain. And so till eventually you have this response as some threat comes along and you relax and open to it. You don't get dumb about it, but you just relax. Well, we have a microphone over there, so we'll get to you.
I always have a problem with that one, the one about relaxing the craving and the craving being kind of fundamental to one's survival, or at least having, originally been a fundamental part of one's survival, practice for one's survival, is that, like, for example, I'm driving downtown. I've got to go to an important meeting. I'm looking for a parking place. I've got to find a parking place. I didn't give myself enough time. Oh, there's a parking place. Oh, somebody else is going for it. Oh, I'll let them have it. Now I'm looking for the parking place again. It's 5 minutes go by, 10 minutes go by. Finally, I find a place 7 blocks away, and I walk, and I'm half an hour late to the meeting. Okay. And So
it's a great question. There's my website, www.easingawake.com. There's a series of talks on there on the inner landscape, and there's one on dependent origination, where I actually go to this into this at great length. But basically what it is that independent origination, there's a sensory experience. It's pleasant or unpleasant, right? And that's a kind of signal. And if we don't act on it, then it goes into tanha and then into craving, where things tighten up. So the whole issue is whether we can handle those signals before they get out of whack. For example, when I was a kid, this friend of mine had a membership in a swimming pool that was twice Olympic size and had a 5 and a 10 meter platform. You know? And we used to dive off that 10 meter platform. So there were lots of signals there about danger. You know? It would have been crazy, you know, to not be aware of danger. But we learned to manage it. So when tanha comes up, it's a question of knowing it well enough that we can manage those signals before they tip over. And what the Buddha said was that there's the signal, there's this pre-instinctual tightening, and the next thing that happens is called clinging. The mind kind of shrink wraps around it, and that's where the suffering begins. And if we can manage the signals before we get to suffering, then we can, when there's a rough spot comes up in a relationship, you know, we can recognize the signals and we can deal with it without having a fit. Or if we get hungry, we can recognize those signals and take them as signals and not actually go from craving over into clinging where the mind just obsesses about it. But just manage it. And I think, I'm trying to go through this really quickly. The important part of all of this, I think, to incorporate into our practices is the cultivation of nirodha, of equanimity. So that when a difficulty comes along, looking for a parking place, for example, and there's this tightness that comes up, we can actually relax the tightness, but not space out and not get the parking lot, not get the parking space. But we can negotiate that from a place that's not so driven. Did any of you ever see the movie Serenity? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a sci-fi movie. Okay, sci-fi. Okay, so they have it. We're over time. What happened there was this planet where they put this stuff in the atmosphere, and it took away basically all the craving, you know, all the tana, and people just kind of, you know, sat down on the park bench and died, you know, so. Or as Uteshaniya puts it, somebody asks him, why is there suffering? And he says, motivation. You know, so we learn to handle the motivation without it actually turning into suffering. So thank you for indulging me and for going a little over there.